Hello, everybody, and even if you don't have a body, I'm the Quantum Jazz Ensemble known as Layman Pascal, and this is the Integral Stages Author Series. Today we're speaking with Lent, Jeremy Lent, who's produced a veritable tome called The Web of Meaning, which summarizes his critique of and vision for human civilization in a world of complex interconnectedness. As an advocate of sacred naturalism and a fan of nonlinear patterning, I'm surely thrilled to have him here. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Layman, and I'm thrilled to be in conversation with you. Thank you.
So, first things first, where can all the Uncle Bobs and everyone else out there get their hands on this book? Where is it for sale?
It's pretty much sale online in most English speaking countries right now. There's actually one edition that got published by a UK publisher and another that is the same book, but just has a different cover, published by New Society Publishers in North America. I think Australia too, and hopefully we'll have some translations out there in before too long.
And who helped you put this book together, either practically or morally?
I have a couple of pages of acknowledgements at the end. The list is vast because it goes back to some of the great sages from earliest times, like Lao Tzu and the Buddha and the traditions of indigenous knowledge that are mostly nameless. And it goes to modern scientists, leaders in complexity theory, leaders in understanding new ways of perceiving biology, as well as people I've been fortunate to have a deeper, more direct connections with, people like Fritjof Capra and others who were influential. So it's just a vast array of people and sources. I feel almost like I've been facilitating a multi-millennia conversation spanning thousands of miles, thousands of years, and helping to put this together into this web of meaning.
I'm curious about the update to that ancient conversation that's going on here, because I really enjoyed this book, and I think partly because it's very leading edge, but also it was a little bit nostalgic for me. It reminded me of a class of books that were formative in my own thinking. You know, when I was in the eighth grade, my science teacher gave me Dancing Woolly Masters by Gary Zukav, right? And that's complexity, quantum mechanics, neg entropy, brain resonance, ecology, and how that all jives with Taoist wisdom.
Yeah.
And it kind of offered a naturalist, rationalist, spiritual, mysterious convergence that would give us a quantum leap beyond mechanism and dualism and the degradation of the world. So
right,
that's what I felt was being handed to me as a kid, as like the wisdom of at least my 20th century elders. And I felt a lot of those same things come back up for me when I read this book. And I'm curious what you think moves the conversation forward. You know, as like a transdisciplinary new science thinker, what's in here that wouldn't have been in a volume like this in the 90s?
Yeah, you know, it's so true what you say, I'm happy to answer your question, but also it raises another question in my mind, which I think needs to be explored. If these ideas were out there decades ago, where do they go? How did they not sort of have traction? And maybe the answer to your question is leads to the answer to that other question, because I think what has happened in the last few decades is there's been such advances in modern systems sciences like complexity theory, like systems biology and ecology, complexity and network theory, chaos theory, and all of these sciences have actually validated and corroborated these ideas that were kind of totally almost unheard of back in those days that you're talking about. And so in a way, what I'm trying to do is show how this sense of deep interconnectedness is profoundly scientific. It's not like some spiritual thing you have to have some leap of faith. In fact, as I argue in the book, the ontological leap of faith is actually what people mostly view as scientifically true, like this kind of notion of reductionism. There is nothing other than just little bits and particles that hit against each other. That's all the universe is ultimately meaningless. That, as I kind of show in the book, is the ontological leap of faith. If we take what science really tells us, it leads us, it points us to what certain wisdom traditions have been talking about for millennia, and really a sense of this deep interconnectedness.
So there's this distorted, reductionistic version of what science and society is, right? And that haunts this book the way it haunts the world. And I'm really intrigued by that. You know, the book opens with the parable of Uncle Bob, who's ideologically indoctrinated into the dog-eat-dog, rat-race view of the world, which he thinks is pragmatic and grounded in realism.
Right.
And the character of Bob is doing double duty. On the one hand, he's a person who has basic underlying human concerns and capacities to evolve and change. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, in giving what you call the speech, he's a kind of mouthpiece for a world system that is speaking through him.
Right.
What is that system? What entity possesses Uncle Bob?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, in a way, we're all mouthpieces for that system, unless we really try to reconvene our sense of what's going on out there, because that is part of this system. Is it actually, it's a self-organized, self-created process, and everyone learns it, and then they kind of become mouthpieces for it to self-reinforce it. And so what is that system? Well, basically, it's a worldview, really. I mean, and one of the things that I write about a lot, not just in this book, The Web of Meaning, but in my earlier book, The Patterning Instinct, is how worldviews so powerfully affect our very conceptions of reality, and they actually affect history. They affect the unfolding of human history. And one of the reasons worldviews are so powerful is that we don't see them. You know, just like a fish that's swimming in water never even realizes it's in water because that's all it knows. Most of us live our lives according to what we think is reality. We don't go around saying, oh, well, my worldview says this and somebody else's worldview says that, but I'm choosing this one. We just assume that is reality. But it's only once we actually get to perceive that it's a lens, a constructed lens through which we're understanding things, that we then kind of get somewhat liberated to ask ourselves, well, are there other ways to make sense of the world that actually are more correct, are more meaningful? And one of the things that I show in this book is that this current worldview that we have is not just dangerous, and in my view, driving a whole civilization to destruction, it's plain wrong, according to what it's meant to see as the core source of validity, which is science. That modern science shows us that this worldview that we think is scientific is actually not scientific.
How do we get to that place where we cease to experience the worldview merely as reality and experience it as a lens? What makes that difference?
Yeah, that's a great question. It took me years of my own personal research and a voyage of discovery, if you will, to get to that place. And I think maybe the first element has to be some sort of recognition that something maybe doesn't quite feel right within our own way of making sense of things. It's a little bit like the whole notion of in the Matrix, you know, like, do you take the red pill or the blue? Like, it's like something doesn't quite feel right. Because if you think everything's feeling just right and you're feeling there's nothing wrong, nothing to question, there's no, why would you even try to break out of it? But if you begin with almost like a little bit like that grain of sand in the oyster shell, like begins to not quite be acceptable, then you need to start asking the deep questions. And in my voyage of discovery, what I saw was that you needed to start looking at how other cultures made sense of the universe to begin to see that there were other ways to look at things. And at the same time, one of the most important things to do is to recognize that what we think is mainstream science is actually, well, at least what most people think is mainstream science, is actually a particular methodology within science known as reductionism that is very powerful, but doesn't necessarily speak for a full understanding of humanity and our place in the cosmos.
Sounds like a lot of it involves taking things more seriously, like taking our agitation and discomfort with the way a world works more seriously, and taking more seriously alternative views that we're peripherally aware of that other cultures or other people might hold. But there has to be some way of making that more viscerally real to ourselves. But
yes. Yeah.
I don't know if we know the answer to that, but it seems like a big question.
I think that's right. But I think primarily it has to begin with this recognition of what the Buddhist tradition calls dukkha, basically. And there has to be this recognition of some sense of dissatisfaction in our lives and the intention to try to uncover what is the source of that. Without that, we're not going to go, and no one's going to go anywhere. And then somebody might say, well, supposing I don't have dukkha in my lives, but I would posit that in the world in which we inherit right now, and given our worldview and given our world system, it's virtually impossible not to feel dukkha, that to not actually feel that sense of suffering, that sense of something that's wrong somewhere. Actually, you'd have to be so numbed to your life that it's not that the dukkha wouldn't be there. It's just that you're too numbed to even recognize that it is there.
Seems like we have a kind of built-in defense mechanism whereby we offload the dukkha to some other figure, right? Like if it weren't for those crazy, irrational, destructive people over there, then the system would be running smoothly. Or if it weren't for a few bad apples, modernity would be just getting the job done properly. That we have this way of insulating ourselves from the dukkha by imagining that it's more rare, or that it's something, it's an attribute of the other, but doesn't actually pertain to my world.
I agree with you. And I think, I think actually Buddhism has a lot to say about that, because it's true not just of how we relate in terms of our stories we make about society and culture, but also just the stories we make about ourselves. That's where meditation practice, if done skillfully, can be so valuable, because you begin to realize that, you know, when you say that person did that bad thing and made me feel so bad, and then you begin to realize actually it wasn't that person that made me feel bad, it was the way in which I reacted to what happened that was what made me feel bad. And you begin to deconstruct your own stories, and that enables you, that awakens this possibility of actually going to a deeper place of recognizing the self-created structures that limit our experience. And that's both true on that sort of internal spiritual level, as well as our global political and societal level too.
When did you first get interested in Buddhism and attracted to the various esoteric traditions of the East?
Yeah, it's only been, it's been like the last 15 years or so of my life. For the first part of my life, I knew absolutely close to zero about Buddhism, about Taoism, and about anything like meditation, or you name it. In fact, even though I did feel like a seeker in as a student and an undergraduate, I ended up taking a path in my life where I actually went into that whole mainstream Uncle Bob world, if you will, the world according to this kind of mindset that is so dominant. And I went into business. I got an MBA. I started an internet company, took it public. And I constructed this world based on the ideology of our mainstream culture. And it seemed very successful, except it didn't quite feel right. It felt almost like it wasn't really me, as if I was an imposter. And then it all crashed around me, because my wife at the time, who passed away some years back, my first wife, she became very sick. I left the company to look after her. The company collapsed. And I felt everything collapsing around me, but I was determined that whatever I did in my future would be truly meaningful. And I realized I wasn't going to take somebody else's word for it. I wanted to find out for myself, where did meaning actually arise? I didn't want to, in the final days of my life, look back and say, damn, made another mistake. What a waste, if only I had gone in this other direction. So I wanted to really do it right this time. And it was a journey of many years to really try to uncover at least my own answers to some of those questions.
If there's one thing I know about you, it's that you're a guy who loves a good slime mold. what do you think is so fascinating about them, and what do they tell us about ourselves and the systems we live in?
Well, I think, you know, the The first thing I love about slime molds, not that I have to confess, I've never actually seen one in person, or at least maybe I have once or twice in early childhood, because I've got some image in my mind, because they're these kind of big, gooey, yellowish substances that generally people come across in forests and slightly damp areas, and they're quite big. And they look, I think, pretty disgusting. And I even the name, I think that's my favorite thing about it. The name is so awful, a slime mold. How could anything sound worse? But what's so amazing about them is that they show some of what I explore in the book in some detail is the incredible intelligence in all of nature. And this is something that I think is a fundamental rejiggering, if you will, of understanding humanity's place in life on this earth and the cosmos, is recognizing that nature itself has a profound intelligence that we have tended to either discount or utterly ignore or pretend doesn't exist in our sort of mainstream worldview, but science has begun to uncover. And scientists have found, the thing about the slime mold is that some slime molds are actually just one cell, one gigantic cell with millions of different nuclei. Some are multiple cells, but you can actually see their intelligence, because if you put a slime mold, like what they do is they like to eat little grains of food. And if you put this big blob of a slime mold in the middle of a maze, and you put certain grains of food in the edges of the maze, the slime mold will solve the maze faster than a human being could do. It'll find the shortest distance between these different sources of food and then reform itself so it actually makes the most efficient way of accessing the food. And in fact, it does this so incredibly well and deals with such complexity in doing this that scientists have actually looked at, they've developed models of roadways, looking at the road network in the US or Japan or Canada. And then they've taken, instead of sitters, they put little breadcrumbs there and seen what slime molds do. And they will actually self-organize into a network of roadways that are more efficient than what our civilization has actually done when we've actually developed these pathways. So it's just one incredible manifestation of how nature has this deep intelligence that we've given very little credit to until recent times.
Well, speaking of nature, and I know this is a big question, but could you give us a sort of overview of the history of the world from your point of view? Like, life gets started, life has some skills, animals introduce something, humans introduce something, we somehow get from indigeneity to where we are now, and what's about to happen next? Like, what's your story of life on Earth?
it's an incredible story. And it's the cliche phrase, it's the greatest story ever told. And yet it's barely been told because it's only recently been discovered. And it's a story that to me leads to really a sense of deep awe and a sense of the sacredness of life of this earth, of this planet we're on. And, this particular story doesn't necessarily go back to the beginnings of the universe, like 14 billion years ago, but goes back to about 4.5 billion years ago with Earth being formed. And amazingly, just within a very short time, geologically speaking, maybe a few hundred million years on Earth, even while I was being bombarded with meteorites and all kinds of like strange things happening to this sort of almost still newly formed planet, something happened. Life self-emerged, life self-organized and emerged on this rock. And this is something I go into in some deep investigation in this book, because this is one of the greatest miracles, really, and I expect it probably has shown itself elsewhere in the universe, but we may never even know about it. But one of the most amazing things about this universe is that it created the conditions that life could emerge. And scientifically, we now get to understand that what this story is about, it has to do with entropy and negative entropy. And one of the things that physics tells us is that the universe is undergoing irreversible entropy. Entropy, it's called the second law of thermodynamics. And basically it says that everything, all energy and matter dissipates. It loses organization and it moves towards an equilibrium. And what physicists say is like many, many billions of years in the future, the whole universe will just die this heat death of complete dissipation. It's the most sad story in a way. And someone like Einstein said, the one thing that physics will never change is that second law of thermodynamics. That is the fundamental. But here's what happened. There is a set of autocatalytic pre-life molecules on this earth that actually staged a rebellion against entropy, against this law. They may not have repealed the law, but locally, on this one planet, they said they actually took that entropy and they organized it through metabolism into a way that they were able to make self-organize, create themselves and continually regenerate themselves in a process that's known as autopoiesis. And here's the amazing thing. Life has never stopped doing that for 4 billion years. So this kind of rebellion against entropy has been going on for 4 billion years. And each of us as living entities are part of this unfolding. We're really part of this gigantic sort of a rebellion that may continue for who knows how long. And once we begin to see that, it changes our very way of recognizing who we are, our core sense of identity.
Okay. Good stuff.
Of course, I haven't even gotten to humanity.
Yeah, I think a lot of our questions will circle back around the human question as we go along here. One thing that came up for me when I was reading it was, you know, I love Catch-22, the book, the movie. There's even a really good TV miniseries of it. You use the character of Yossarian from Catch-22 sort of as a symbol of individualism and the individual's sense that it's reasonable for them to participate selfishly in systems. But yeah, what would you say to the argument that that's actually a really good heuristic method for serving the interconnected web? That's kind of the invisible hand argument, that if you look after yourself and maybe your family and your local situation, you're actually maximizing your contribution to the overall benefit of the whole. Do we need to think about the whole and aim at the whole to serve the whole, or can it be done by thinking selfishly?
Yeah, this is a question that gets to the fundamentals of what I explore in the book. Yeah, just by way of context, I love Catch-22 too. In fact, I loved it so much that when I did English literature as an undergraduate in Cambridge, and I actually wrote my dissertation on Catch-22 along with a couple of other novels, and I just thought it was the best thing. I quoted in my book, because there's this one point, this is a sort of core element in Catch-22, where the hero Yossarian doesn't want to fly any more missions over Italy, he doesn't want to get killed, and his commanding officer says, but if everyone did and said that, then where would we be? We wouldn't be able to win the war. And Yossarian says, well, if everybody said that, then I'd be a damn fool if I was the only one who didn't. And I just thought that was so brilliant when I came across that. And in a way, I sort of found that as a liberating way of breaking through some of these stories that our society told us. It felt like, yes, this is a way to really sort of break out this kind of groupthink that can be so constricting. And that, of course, is in many ways the fundamental element of libertarianism in its modern form. And to your point, there's this ideology that goes, this is what it's about. Everybody doing their own selfish thing gets to make the world a better place. It's the invisible hand. And that's part of Uncle Bob's kind of speech. And here's the thing. Actually, for us to truly fulfill who we really are as human beings is actually to recognize that our identity is not just this fixed, separate entity that has nothing to do with the rest of the world around us. But we begin to recognize, once we start to look at the connections between things, that our actual identity is part of this whole ongoing, what's often called a holarchy, a sense of a self-organized piece of which we are, which we have them within us, and we're part of something bigger that extends at massive scales all the way to this whole living earth. And once we begin to see that, and this is not just a sense of, well, you could look at it one way or you could look at it another way, but this is where what evolutionary biology shows us is that what actually makes us truly human. So, and what differentiates us from other primates like orangutans or gorillas or whatever is that actually as humans, we evolved to learn to cooperate together. And we evolved a sense of group identity. And that led to us having actual emotions within us to do with our group identity, a sense of fairness, a sense of compassion, a sense of loving people who we feel are generous, just all these different elements in a sense, if we see something wrong being done, being ready to even put ourselves at risk to put it right. These are not things that we think we should do. These come from our core sense of who we are as human beings. And our modern society has eliminated that from our sense of identity. It's told us that those things don't really exist. We're told that actually nature is selfish, we're all selfish genes, and what makes humans unique is like we're just better at being selfish, and the more competitive are the ones that win, and that's how evolution works. All these things are basically myths. In fact, what we are as human beings, yeah, we are individuals, absolutely. And we're also part of groups, and we really fulfill ourselves. We can really live a life of much more a fuller sense of well-being when we recognize that. And when our identity can expand, not just to other humans around us and to other groups that we share ideas with, but then to all of life on Earth. And we recognize that our identity is not just fixed, because when we try to live our lives according to a fixed identity, we actually close off vast elements of what it truly can mean to be a full human being on this earth.
Do you think the West in general and modernity in particular is uniquely predisposed toward the atomistic, mechanistic, individual mode? Or is it something, you know, as compared to say indigenous and Eastern styles, Or is it a tension that plays out within every culture between people who are deeper and people who are more foolish, between people who are more complex, interconnected thinkers and people who are more selfish, individualistic thinkers?
Mm. Yeah, that's a great question. And interestingly, I do think that to some degree, it's a tension that can play out in every culture. But as I really explore this in some detail in my earlier book, The Patterning Instinct, which looks at really how worldviews evolved and how they shifted through history. And what I identified is that really in the West, really beginning with the ancient Greeks, there was a shift in that balance where actually the predominant way of making sense of the world was this more of a split way, which led to this atomistic kind of thinking. You actually see in ancient China, some philosophers who are barely even known outside of scholarship right now, who actually sounded more like somebody like, say, Plato or some of these earlier Greek philosophers who are more the atomists, but they got ridiculed in ancient China. And actually the way of thinking that became dominant was one that looked much more about interconnection and systemic ways of us being connected in a kind of a web of life. And that formed this notion of the Tao. But in the West, this atomistic way of thinking was the one that actually got to be dominant. And it got to be so dominant that any other way of thinking really sort of got to be it was there through the Western tradition, but I call it actually the moonlight tradition, because it's as if you look up this at the sky during the day, the sun's really bright and the moon might actually be right there, but it's so much paler in its light, so you don't even see it's there. So similarly, this moonlight tradition, a tradition of looking at life as being deep into connectedness, was there in the West, but it got obliterated by the dominant tradition, which said we're separate. Humans are separate from the rest of nature. We're even separate from ourselves in the sense that we have a soul separate from a body, and each individual is separate from other humans. So it's this worldview of separation became dominant in the West.
I'm curious, there's sort of an ambiguity about worldview. We talked about this a few minutes ago, right? Is a worldview sort of a thing we can conceptualize as a lens we're using, or are we experiencing it just as what we think of as reality? And sort of in that ambiguity, you can sort of think of worldviews as sort of, I don't know, coming upon us unawares, or as being something we think about. And this gets to the issue of how we change, because on the one hand, if we think, well, it's our idea system is wrong, if we could just infect each other with a new idea system, then a changed world would be downstream of that. But there's also this other argument, which kind of crops up through the book, that reality is more participatory, more based on the way we enact things rather than the concepts that we use. And in that case, worldviews might be a kind of readout of just the protocols and procedures we're engaged in the world. So, mm-hmm. You know, when we think about change, is it mostly about changing what we think, or is there a danger in being too top heavy in that respect?
Yeah. Yeah. And interesting question. And yeah, I think there is a danger in being too top heavy in that respect. I mean, we see that in just modern day issues, things like, you know, trying to persuade people that, that we're experiencing human-made climate change, if they don't want to hear that. And what studies have shown is that actually it's not like people need to be made aware of something. In fact, oftentimes the people who are best educated are the ones who are most resistant to actually getting their minds changed by simple logical argument, because they're better at finding out, at coming up with rationalizations for why that's not true or whatever. So there has to be, for the change to happen, it has to happen at some sort of deeper layer. And in fact, that is part of the power of worldviews, that they are implicit much more than they're explicit. I mean, it's not like in every culture, you know, once someone's hit the age of like 8 or 9 or whatever, some elder puts them on the lap and says, now, let me tell you about our worldview. Here's how we see things. And this happens here. And this is what causes that. And we don't believe that. That doesn't happen. What happens is that a child, in just the same way that a child learns language, when an infant is born, nobody says to a little baby, now you've got to figure out our language, okay? You know, and the baby just does, because the baby has what I call a patterning instinct. And she sort of hears the sounds, and then she relates that to actions and what something feels like, and slowly she begins to build a pattern of meaning, which becomes her natural language. The same is true with the culture and the worldview. You begin to see as you're growing up, oh, this is the way things get done, and this is the way men act versus women act, and this is what you're meant to wear on this particular day. And slowly these things become implicit until they're so much embedded in your cognition that you don't even think about them. That's what the world is. And that's why a worldview is so powerful. So, given that we do as humans have a conceptual consciousness, I do think it's important to actually look at what science tells us and the reasons why what we're told is true, is not true. But something has to happen at a deeper layer, has to happen within what I call a whole sort of integrative consciousness. All of us are feeling tones, and has to again, has to begin by recognizing something's not quite right. And then, and this is why I actually feel there is this potential for a transformation in worldviews, because our current worldview basically has to tell us to damp down and really reject those core elements in our felt identity that are for real. As humans, we do feel a sense of connectedness within ourselves. We do feel a desire for love and connection with others around us. We do care about our community. We care about all of life. We love to feel a richness in nature. We want to feel we're doing good and that we're leaving a good legacy for our children and grandchildren. All these are our core human emotions. So when our dominant culture tries to destroy those emotions, it can't actually destroy them, but what it can do is set up barriers within our whole sort of being to sort of numb ourselves to those felt emotions. But what I'm offering in this book is not just a different way of thinking, but a way of relating to our whole being that actually really celebrates and enables to flourish those core elements within us that are our true humanity.
You think the more we can remove some of these barriers and buffers and embrace the actual topology of ourselves in the world, that that sort of spontaneously transforms worldviews?
Well, I think that it has the potential to lead to a tipping point that could lead that worldview to be transformed. In fact, worldviews are incredibly stable. They're incredibly resilient. And you can see things like something like the Christian worldview, stable for 2 millennia. If you look at the traditional Chinese worldview, even longer, like 2.5 or 3 or more millennia was a certain worldview. And if you try to look at how worldviews actually change, what you see is that it can be through an endogenous or an exogenous disruption to the system. And they're very rare. But if we look at Europe, for example, the rise in our modern scientific worldview came about through more of an endogenous change in the system. There was a nucleus of a new way of thinking that got to be so powerful and that it got to actually rejigger how things worked in such a way that it started to disrupt the system from within. If you look at the traditional Chinese worldview, we see an exogenous variable. And Confucianism was around for millennia. Then the West came along and they humiliated the leaders in China in the 19th century, things like the Opium War. And new generations of people grew up in China rejecting what their parents had told them, even if it had been seemingly true for millennia, because they saw it was no longer valid. And they looked to the West, in fact, for new ways of making sense of things. Now, if we look at our current worldview right now, what is it that could cause it to change? And well, I would say that we are looking at some exogenous variables that are hugely disruptive, like climate breakdown, like ecological destruction. And we're looking at endogenous variables, like this rise in inequity, in the inequalities that are so extreme that people are feeling there's something wrong. And when these things come together, I feel that there's this potential, in fact, for things, as things begin to unravel, for people to look around for some different way of making sense of things. And that's really what I'm trying to offer in this book, is a foundation for a different way of making sense.
Well, one of the different styles of sense-making that comes up in the book is the ancient Taoist notion of Wu Wei, of a kind of effortless effort or a cooperatively naturalistic form of activity. It's very attractive. But it also seems very embedded in a traditional world space that was considered to be sort of eternal and cyclic and largely unchanging, except for deviating or not deviating from the Tao. Do you think Wu Wei can be used as an effective principle in a world of radical and accelerating changes? Like, does it tell us also how to make things different, or does it only tell us how to return to a sameness?
Yeah, well, I think Wu Wei is it gives us a hint of what's possible. I don't think it has all the answers in itself, in this concept of Wu Wei. And for somebody who's not familiar with Wu Wei, it's this traditional Taoist recognition or sense of how you can act in a way that, a good translation of it is effortless action. And they saw that in contrast to this human-driven way of what they call purposive action, or Yu Wei, which is the opposite of Wu Wei, which is, they used to describe it as things like using a pump to pump water up a hill or something, which of course is exactly what we do. That's really almost the defining quality of civilization. So in a way, and I begin the book by looking at Wu Wei because it does sort of offer this stark contrast that the Taoists said the rest of non-human life lives according to Wu Wei. And they saw it as almost this mystical objective in spiritual practice to get to this place of being in Wu Wei. But then if civilization is by definition against Wu Wei, where does that leave us as humans? It's like either or. Do we actually go with our sort of conceptual, uniquely human way of being and just say, forget about Wu Wei? And or do we try to reject civilization and just say, like, this is totally destructive, but we think we can't go back anyway, so we seem to be stuck. But what I offer in this book is this recognition of the sense that actually we can integrate them both. We can recognize that Wu Wei is within us all as humans, even though Descartes told us that I think, therefore I am. Therefore, like, there's this sense we've inherited from this modern worldview that as humans, our only identity is that conceptual consciousness, that Wu Wei. But actually, what modern cognitive science and evolutionary biology shows us is that our true identity as humans is both that conceptual way of thinking and what I call our animate intelligence, that same intelligence we share with a slime mold, which is really allows us to be in that kind of Wu Wei place. But as humans, we're capable of developing an integrative intelligence, one that doesn't have these two sense of intelligence, conceptual and animate, in opposition, but we can actually lead towards integrating them. So the animate intelligence can be informed by this kind of uniquely human conceptualization, and our conceptual intelligence can really be enlivened and get its sense of purpose and meaning through connecting with all of life on Earth, rather than seeing ourselves as separate.
Those integrative or hybridization possibilities are really compelling, I think. I've got a bit of a background in Gurdjieffian traditions, or at least mm-hmm. some of them. And one of the discourses that goes on there is a discussion about essence and personality, in the sense that we have a kind of identity that stands out in the first few years of life as mostly consisting of inherited instincts and observations and thoughts that go on us in delta and theta wave brain states. Mm. And then that's slowly replaced by a kind of socioculturally informed alpha, beta wave, educated, culturally indoctrinated personality that doesn't destroy the other one, but relegates it to the subconscious. So we don't see its functioning very much. Mm-hmm. And so their whole spiritual approach from one angle is about how you bring those together, how you generate a meta intelligence that gets to fuse them to produce a more authentic, more capable human being. So what are those processes in your mind? Like, how does integration of the animate and the, you know, socio-conscious personality, how do they come together? What do we do in ourselves to make them a better team?
Mm. Yeah. Great question. And well, I think given that certainly in the West, we're so dominated by that one layer, that what I call our conceptual consciousness, that symbolic thinking, that I think the first step really has to be to simply recognize that our identity is a combination of those two. And in fact, I begin the first few chapters of my book really go into this, and is kind of connecting with our embodied consciousness, with our embodied being. And there's any number of ways we can do that. I mean, one is through certain types of meditation. What I personally have found incredibly valuable have been traditional Chinese forms of energy practices such as Qigong or Tai Chi. And these are so powerful. And it's not surprising, of course, they came from traditional China, because that was the worldview that actually led to these skills being developed over many generations. But they kind of allow you to feel into the true sort of wisdom of the body. And you begin to realize over time, you actually begin to shift your identity somewhat and begin to realize, I'm not like just a mind being in a body, but I'm actually also a body that has a mind. And it's a subtle but very powerful shift in identity, which meditation alone doesn't necessarily lead to. Because oftentimes in kind of classic mindfulness meditation, a teacher might say to you something like, you know, be aware of your body, you know, be aware of the feelings. But it's still me. As this conceptual consciousness or this conceptual attention being aware of those feelings, whereas the and more energy practices, almost like the body itself is aware that it has the mind. It's a very different anchor. There's other things like dance, things like just simply being in nature and connecting with all of life around us. And if done skillfully and intentionally, psychedelics can be incredibly powerful way of breaking out of some of the constraints that our society puts us in. But again, I think it all has to begin with an intention first of wanting to actually explore a more integrated way of being, and then finding which of these paths feels more alive for you. Because in my view, each person has their own pathway, which is unique to them.
You mentioned some of the traditions of qi work and exercises. And, you know, in your mind, is it mostly just a metaphor or a conceptual tool for privileging harmony and embodied flow and integrative well-being? Or do you associate it with an actual energetic phenomenon of some kind, whether that's bioelectromagnetic or maybe something else physics hasn't totally tracked yet?
No, I love where you're going in this, because really one of my key sort of fundamental principles of my exploration over years was I didn't want to take any concept as some sort of spiritually something that's there if I couldn't actually really explain it scientifically, if it didn't make sense to me in some way that my rational brain, that conceptual consciousness, could also make sense of. And so I explored this question myself in some depth. And really, to me, what is most helpful is realizing that this Chinese word qi really relates quite simply to energy and or matter. And, you know, when Einstein came up with his famous equation, E equals mc squared, he showed, according to modern physics, energy and matter are not essentially different. They're two different forms, two different manifestations of something that is underlying. Then, and so once we begin to realize that, then we can say, okay, if we can accept it, if we can just kind of think of qi in those terms, what's critical, and to me, is this other term that actually about 1,000 years ago in Song Dynasty China, they used as a way of explaining the universe, which it was called Li, and Li refers to the principles of organization by which qi is manifested, which determines if some qi looks like a piece of rock or stone, or some qi is like air, or some qi is like electromagnetic radiation or whatever. And it's those principles of connection that actually modern science begins to unfold, and things like complexity science, chaos theory, and energetics. And in fact, there have been, you know, some actually high quality scientifically verifiable studies looking at all these different very subtle layers of energy activity happening in the body, happening around the detectable and just outside of the body, and in fact happening within cells and the ways in which cells relate to each other. And when you begin to realize that, you can see that recognizing that there are energy flows in your body, recognizing that there are ways to skillfully be aware of those, connect those, and even actually help to redirect them, is far from woo-woo. It's actually woo-way. It's actually scientifically valid. It's not just some sort of made-up spiritual nonsense. And so we don't have to sort of jettison science to get into a really deep sense of deep connectivity within ourselves. And we recognize that in our own hormones. When you actually go quite deep into this kind of internal qigong modality, you can begin to actually get some more and more aware of these deep layers within your own consciousness of where certain hormonal triggers start, and you can feel them move through the body, and you can even begin to subtly help those deep sort of lower subconscious layers in the body to redirect themselves and to actually get to act in more harmonious ways.
As I was reading this book, I found myself thinking a lot about the relationship between complication and complexity. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that came up for me that I hadn't really thought before was I started to see how our ancestors could have conflated those or missed the difference. Because when you break something down into, you analyze it into very simple constitutive parts, then you have a complicated system where things can go together. There is a complex system present, which is you. You're the one looking at it and you go, oh, that makes sense how we can do it, like by this analytic deconstruction. And you don't necessarily notice that you're missing the real living organized complexity of the world, because it's actually present. You're seeing it reflected back to yourself in the gaps between all these little components you've laid out.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to see why they wouldn't have noticed there's a difference, but there is a difference and it's huge.
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, really, that difference between complicated and complexity is, in a way, one of the defining sort of fault lines between the Western way, the dominant way of looking at things, and other non-Western and modern systems science-based ways of looking at things. And just in case anyone's puzzled still about how these are different, there's a simple way of looking at it is something that is complicated is something that we can actually identify all of the different parts and figure out how those parts relate to each other in principle, perfectly well. So something like a jumbo jet, or you know, a Jeff Bezos's spaceship, or whatever. Those are complicated, incredibly complicated, but they're not complex. Because when something is complex, they are self-organized and they have multiple complex feedback loops where lots of the different parts relate to each other in reciprocal and non-linear ways. And anything that's complex is by definition not completely subject to predetermination. So a single cell in your body is complex. Like a little worm in the earth is complex, but a jumbo jet is not. And if a jumbo jet were complex, then you'd be well advised not to get on it for your next journey, because we wouldn't know for sure if it wasn't going to crash or not. Because something that is complex can't be exactly predicted. That's why we can't predict the weather even more than a day or two out, because it's part of a complex system. And that's where Western thinking kind of went, I was going to say went wrong, but it went both right and wrong in a sense, is that it used this powerful metaphor that actually nature is complicated, but they threw out the complexity. They just said nature is basically a very complicated machine. And that's incredibly effective way. It's a simplifying assumption, but very effective way of actually making sense of nature. And that's where over-centuries, the scientific revolution then led to the discovery of elements in chemistry or genes in biology by looking at the tiny little parts and recognizing how they worked, or like different particles in physics. But that was so effective that a lot of scientists and then mainstream thinkers outside of that made the mistake of actually thinking that that must explain everything about the universe, because look how much is explained already. And so then they rejected any sense that there's actually ways of understanding the universe that don't arise from breaking it down to those separate little parts. That's what I call the ontological leap of faith, of ontological reductionism, which is really a belief system that is no more founded in science than believing in God or whatever it might be. But complexity is what modern system science has begun to uncover. And interestingly, it's only really been through the development of the information technology revolution and computers that are able to handle some of this complexity, rather than just being this mysterious kind of goo of stuff that we can never figure out. We begin to see actually principles underlying what is complex. And basically, anything that is living is by nature, by definition, complex, not complicated, but complex.
Well, you mentioned cells there, and there's an interesting section in the book about whether the cell or the gene should be viewed as the basic unit of biological analysis. Which one do you think we should choose, and what difference might that make?
Yeah, well, and again, our mainstream culture, we think that what science tells us is the gene is the unit. You know, Richard Dawkins did such a great job of popularizing this notion of the selfish gene. And ever since Crick and Watson discovered the shape of the gene, that's been this sense that's now pervaded modern culture. Everything is genetically determined. Genetic determinism, it's sometimes called. But actually what biologists have now understood in the last couple of decades or more, is that it's simply a limited, just like the machine metaphor is limited for nature, the gene metaphor is limited in understanding biology, that actually the cell interacts with the gene, and the cell actually uses proteins to tell different parts of the gene what to turn on to make new proteins. So it's this incredibly reciprocal, complex feedback loop. And so some people have argued that actually the cell should be the determining, the sort of fundamental unit, because that's what really determines what goes on in life. Personally, I think looking for a fundamental unit is a category error in itself, because what I think this is what I try to really uncover a lot in this book, is that actually what really is a fundamental essential truth about our reality is this deep interconnectedness and the way everything, it's actually in the way that things relate to each other that we learn more about things a lot of the time than the things themselves. And that can be true of tiny little systems like a cell or systems like galaxies. And it's the interconnections themselves that are oftentimes more meaningful. And in fact, in a way, I describe in the book that we can understand meaning itself as arising from the interconnectivity of things. So I think any look for a fundamental unit is in itself as really an ontological mistake. We need to recognize really what the core Buddhist teaching of dependent origination has been saying for millennia, that everything is dependent for its arising on essentially every other thing in this interconnected web.
So we've got this, we've got a biosphere, we've got an interconnected web of cells evolving and changing and doing their negentropic processing. And right now we're sort of reaching out from beyond the Earth into nearby space, extending these negentropic processes. How do you view the relationship between, the biospheric scale and the solar system scale, right? Are we starting to populate that with a richer, higher grade of negentropic processes? Or is the solar system a complex, self-organizing, maybe even higher grade system in which we've evolved to play some role?
Yeah, that is another of these huge questions that I think so important to take a look at, because if we take what I was saying earlier about life being this process of negative entropy and humans, humans along with all of life are really part of this, then it's very easy for people to look at the fact that, well, a couple of billion years from now, as the sun begins to undergo its changes, it's going to be too hot for life to exist in this current form on Earth. And so we don't have that long. And so we better start to populate the galaxies if we really want life to continue, beyond a fairly limited timeframe. Let's do it. And there's a certain excitement and fascination that I share in that sense of that is possible through our technology, through our conceptual consciousness. We can break the bounds even of the Earth itself and connect. And maybe there's other life forms out there in the galaxy that we can be part of. And there is this kind of somewhat mind-boggling notion that maybe in the distant, distant future, we can connect with other life. And there can be this sense of, that is maybe the deep purpose of life, to connect with other forms and continue this negative entropy in who knows what ways that we can't even conceive of. I love that vision, but it misses something. And what it misses is the fact that we haven't yet learned as human beings how to live properly and harmoniously just on our own little Earth. I mean, the history of colonialism, the last few hundred years, and the destruction that we're doing, where we're actually right now is in our civilization causing the sixth extinction of species on Earth since life began. Others have been caused through things like asteroids and volcanoes. This is caused by our own species destroying other life, including some of the most beautiful, intelligent life forms out there, such as species of whales and elephants, you name it. Until we've learned how to actually live in a symbiotic way with our own relatives on this earth, I don't think we as humans are morally ready to start to even think about exploring other solar systems or the galaxy or anything else like that. I think if we did, we'd end up in some sort of scenario, a little bit like, you know, the incredible film Avatar, you know, where we'd take this civilization is currently based on wealth accumulation and extraction, and use it, if we did have the power, to destroy other forms of life out there. We need to get our own culture and civilization to a greater level of harmonious living on this earth before I think we're ready to deal with going beyond it.
Well, from the beyond to the within, I'm a big fan of pluralistic models of the psyche. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about this fascinating idea that I and myself are two distinct neural attractors in a relationship to each other.
Yeah, that's one of the ways in which I think we can begin to uncover some of these questions we were actually discussing a little bit earlier about this notion of our conceptual and animate consciousness, and how can we live this kind of integrated way, and all that kind of stuff, is this realization that as humans, it's strange to even conceive of, but we actually do have this a split consciousness. And there's a very easy way to recognize that. And if I say to you, for example, you know, like, I'm not happy about what this work I've been doing. I've been really too hard on myself. I'm beginning to hate myself for what I'm doing. But I think, you know, now I'm kind of shifting things a bit so I can really feel more at one with myself. And you know, you get a sense of what I'm talking about. You don't think I've gone nuts. You say, okay, I get that. But this is like as if I'm two people. I'm doing something to myself. I can hate myself, or I can push myself, or then I can be at one with myself, or I can forget myself. So we just, our basic language shows us that there seems to be these two elements within each of us, and I and myself. This is something that George Lakoff and other people in the field of cognitive linguistics uncovered a couple of decades ago. And this is profound realization that points us to the very split consciousness that the Taoists were talking about millennia ago, this difference between the Wu Wei and the Yu Wei. And modern evolutionary psychology and cognitive science has uncovered that we as humans have a highly advanced prefrontal cortex, more advanced than any other mammals around. And it's in that prefrontal cortex that through its mediation, that mediates our ability to look at ourselves as separate entities, to have metacognition, to be aware of ourselves. And so that leads to this, as a child hits age of about 3 to 4 to 5, she begins to develop that metacognition and begins to develop the split self, where she gets to be embarrassed about herself or proud of herself. And that split begins to develop in each human being. So once we recognize that's the case, we can see almost, I have in this chapter in this book that I talk about, it's the most important relationship in your life. Because we're in that relationship, I with myself, every moment I'm taking a breath on this earth. But that relationship can be managed in ways that can be harmful. And I can then live a very difficult inner experience. I can be harsh on myself. I can judge myself. I can spend my life going, damn it, I wish I was better at this. I should do this. And the very quality of my lived experience can be as if you've got two people hating each other. That's not a good way to live one's life. Or we can actually choose to live in a more harmonious way, where I can actually treat myself as if it's like a really close friend. And that doesn't mean basically just letting go and like just being, just sort of doing whatever I want, basically being a jerk. What it means is when I do things that I don't feel right, that I don't feel right about myself, recognize it, try to be curious, be kind, be compassionate, and say, where did that come from? And through that approach that I can use with myself, we can develop what I call a democracy of consciousness, where all the different parts of our consciousness, rather than feeling separate and fragmented and at war with each other, can actually get to be honored and actually lead to, I really think it's foundational to lead to that sense of a truly integrated consciousness.
I'm in. It's beautiful. another interesting neuropsychological thing that comes up in the book is this notion that the seemingly random explorations of the mind in its default mode network are somehow quite similar to the seemingly random hunting patterns exhibited by animals. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I find that so fascinating. there's this section in the book, because the book is divided by these fundamental questions, the existential questions that humans ask ourselves. Who am I? Why am I? Where am I? But there's a section of the book which actually asks, what am I? And this is where I explore these similarities. And what we find is that there are certain patterns of behavior that are exhibited by single cells, exhibited by self-organized, say, flocks of starlings or ants out there in the world, that are also organized, also the way our consciousness itself is self-organized. That once we begin to look at life as being these patterns of self-organization, we see the principles that apply in one place of self-organization in the universe actually applies elsewhere. And we see that principles that apply to, say, like how ants forage, actually, believe it or not, apply to how our nervous system organizes in our consciousness. So if you think about how do ants forage? Well, a lot of them will go along a certain pathways. You know, they use their pheromones to recognize what the other ants are doing, and they'll do their thing, going a little marching along lines. Sometimes ants just seem to wander around, going seemingly at random walk. Scientists have studied those kind of random walks, and they've seen that actually any predator existing in nature does. And it's actually called a Levy walk, named after a mathematician who looked at how they work. And even though they seem random, they're not actually random, they're fractal. They're little sort of loops which go around, and then every now and then the loop gets bigger and you go sort of further out and you explore elsewhere. And what they found is that that is the most efficient way for any kind of animal to explore its environment if they're looking for food or something that's salient to what they want. And given that our very beings are comprised by cells which act in these self-organized patterns, then it seems to make sense that the same principles that nature evolved to be so powerful might apply to our own minds. And so if we think about what we do when we do mind wandering, oftentimes that's viewed by some people as like a negative. Like in meditation, people say, you know, try to recognize when your mind's wandering. It's called monkey mind, bring it back to the present. And in fact, studies have even shown that when people are mind wandering, often their mood is more negative. So it seems like this kind of bad thing we should overcome. But actually, when our mind wanders, it's doing just like those ants are doing. It's actually looking for something that is salient to our consciousness. So if you notice, whenever your mind is wandering, whether you're taking a shower or you're trying to meditate or whatever, it might go to things like, oh, did I lock the car a few minutes ago? Or it might say, you know, God, I can't believe that so-and-so said that to me the other day. I wonder what that means, or I wonder what the medical test will tell me. It goes all these things, but what it's doing is it's looking for something that's salient. And it might not find a lot of salience in one place, so it goes somewhere else. And then it finds something that your whole body starts to feel alive. Oh, yeah, I can't believe what that person said to me. And then you start thinking about, I should say this to them, or wonder what it means for our friendship. And it's very salient. And so that predator, it's like just the ant looking for the piece of food. Those neurons in your mind found something that your whole body wants to explore more in more depth. And so mind wandering is actually a very powerful part of what it means to be not just a human being, but to be any kind of mammal with a nervous system and a brain. And it also can lead to our imagination. That's why people oftentimes will say they have their best ideas when they're showering or whatever, because that's when their mind is free to make these connections that our more constrained way of thinking don't make. But what's so fascinating about that is recognizing that so many of the principles that apply to life in general and the cosmos in general apply to our own consciousness. That far from Descartes' ideas that we're somehow sort of essentially separate from the rest of nature, it's by recognizing what I call the Tao in our own nature that we can truly understand ourselves.
So self-organizing systems share a number of attributes, including seemingly this salience-seeking intelligent behavior.
Right.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, I was speaking with Rupert Sheldrake, and he feels that all self-organizing systems possess subjectivity of some kind, consciousness. Is that going too far? How do we know how far to extrapolate the notion of what all self-organized systems have in common? Should we assume that the sun is conscious?
Yeah, I know. It's a big question. And it's interesting how many people really look at this and try to answer it in one way or another. There's a theory of consciousness coming out of cognitive neuroscience, driven mostly by somebody called Giulio Tononi, and also Christoph Koch is a real follower of that. So these are some of the leading thinkers in neuroscience. And it's called the Integrated Information Theory of Consciousness, which says that basically any system has consciousness to the degree that the connections in that system leads to something greater than the simple linear set of connections themselves, where there's some emergent coherence greater than the simple sum of linear connections. And when you take that methodology and look at something as simple as even an atom, the way it's connected, you can make an argument that there is some tiny level of consciousness, even in things that we think of as inanimate matter. And personally, that makes sense to me, but I think that we'd be making too much of it if we start to say, oh, it shows that the universe is conscious or anything like that. What it just shows that once we start to look at something in a spectrum, then what's much more meaningful is looking at the differences in the layers in that spectrum rather than just saying something's on the spectrum. If something's on the spectrum, but at one extreme end, well, okay, we can accept that, but what does that actually mean? To me, one of the great leaps happens when life first emerged into that sort of greatest story ever told that we were looking at before. And to me, that's where, if we do look at this spectrum of consciousness, even if we accept that everything is conscious to some degree or other, when we see life emerging, it's as if there was this massive phase transition in the rise of the coherence arising out of the self-organized complexity of that. That's probably the single most important step that took place. As life got to be more complex, we saw greater levels of consciousness arising with nervous systems and with mammalian cognitive layers. And even though I think we make more of a fuss about it than deserves, human self-awareness is also a step up in conscious layers. So I think we can accept this possibility. It's a matter of definition, that there is consciousness everywhere in the universe to that very limited degree. I'm just not sure that the implications are as huge as some people make them out to be.
There's a lot of discussion in this book about moral progress. And, you know, it seems like we've been trending in a certain direction of being more sensitive, more morally cognizant entities for a while. Now, you know, does that mean we're just reprogrammable and we've been bullshitting each other into a certain moral trajectory that might even reverse and go in a different direction later? Or do you think we've been doing things that have been allowing our underlying moral instincts to grow more robustly?
Well, first, I try to avoid using that word programmable because that's one of the ways in which this machine metaphor of nature so pervades our discourse that we reinforce it every time we talk about that. Like when we think of humans as being basically these kind of computers that culture can program us or whatever. So I try to, but I do think in general, there is this plasticity to the human patterning instinct that we were looking at before, that is actually one of the greatest features of us as human beings, but it does mean that we tend to be formed very powerfully by the culture in which we're born. And we were talking about worldviews before, and the worldview is a big part of how we do get to be molded by our culture into acting in certain ways. And I think that there's a nuance to this notion of progress. There's this kind of Steven Pinker or Hans Rosling view of progress that is quite widespread in modern thinking, which says like there's been like look at hundreds of years ago, like we lived barbarically, and there's been century by century shifts, almost like a shifting baseline of moral quality. And I think there is absolute elements of truth in that, and something like Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which looks at that in detail, I think is very well researched, and I fully accept a large part of that, but it misses certain elements. One thing it misses is that actually, if you look back earlier at how humans evolved as nomadic hunter-gatherers, we lived a quality of life that was very much attuned to who we really are as human beings, that sense of group identity, there was a sense of really a dislike of violence, a sense of being deeply connected with all of nature around us. And I think with the settling of agriculture about 10 to 12,000 years ago and the concomitant rise of agrarian civilizations, actually we saw a major reduction in the moral quality of human living. We saw notions like aggression being lauded as being the best things available. We saw the sort of warrior cultures. And we see this almost this notion that might is right. And people got to just be proud of enslaving others, of massacring other groups. And that's really where the patriarchy also got established in that period. And that way of thinking has become deeply inculcated in our culture. And it's that way of thinking that looks at the rest of nature as a resource to be exploited. It's the way of thinking that led where Europeans in the 17th century to see non-white, non-Europeans as being also just these kind of lesser people that could be and should be exploited and should be sort of like taught how to believe in Christianity and all that stuff. So even while we do see progress in these last few hundred years, we need to recognize that it's been progress only for certain elements of life on this earth. Certainly it wasn't progress for indigenous populations in North and South America who got decimated by the Western conquerors, and their cultures themselves almost completely annihilated, and they've been working hard to kind of regenerate them, bring them back. It certainly has not been progress for any non-human life on this earth, quite the opposite. Probably the way in which we dominate the earth right now, you could see in some ways as the greatest cataclysm for non-living beings on this earth that ever took place. And even for people who have had some of the material benefits of this progress, the quality of life that our modern consumer culture inculcates in people, this focus on hedonic short-term gratification and really being part of this consumer hedonic treadmill, as it's sometimes called, I think has led to a reduction in well-being in many deeper layers of the human experience. So while accepting there has been some layers of increase in moral progress in mainstream ways of thinking, we need to recognize as a nuanced story, and we need to look at what we can do to actually try to continue the moral progress that there has been, to expand it out and actually move it into new territories.
So there's this, aside from the, let's say, modern imperial mechanistic story of progress, there's this other story of moral and qualitative progress that we can participate in furthering and expanding, and which has, let's say, a futuristic and a neo-archaic element woven together. What is working against that? What's thwarting any of these processes? I saw you use the phrase Wendigo Incorporated, you know, which sort of suggests this notion that the system of underlying egoic separation, or the assumption of separation as a system, has vampiric qualities, has pathological elements that are getting in the way of us furthering this trajectory of integrative well-being. What's working against us? What's holding us back?
Yeah, well, this Wendigo is very powerful image of what's holding us back. The word Wendigo refers to a mythical creature among the Ojibwe Native Americans, it was this creature who had a heart of ice and had this need to continually devour more and more. And it suffered so much because this creature, the more he devoured, the more he needed to devour. So it was this hunger that never got satisfied. And the little kids around the campfires would get terrified because they were told that if the Wendigo creature managed to get his hands on you, he didn't kill you, but he turned you into a Wendigo yourself. And then you'd have this heart of ice and have to devour more and never be satisfied. And so actually the Native Americans at the time, when they saw the Europeans, how they acted in this territory, they realized that it's as though they're totally captivated by this Wendigo monster. So if you actually look at the way our modern capitalist culture is founded on, it essentially is Wendigo. That's why I call it Wendigo Inc. And the very basis of capitalism has been manifested by these for-profit corporations, which are now these massive transnational corporations. And they're based on this sense of maximizing shareholder value as quickly and as powerfully as possible, and always needing more. It's not like they're based on this notion of you should earn a certain return, and after that, you should stabilize. They're based on always having to increase the amounts and compete against others to increase faster and faster. And that is this Wendigo Inc. Global capitalist system that is now devouring the earth. So when we look at how we measure our economy, it's a gross domestic product, and it's meant to be a good year if we sort of hit 3% growth or whatever in GDP. So there's this notion of this this need for infinite growth on a finite planet. And what is fascinating is when we even unravel what GDP refers to, it's not actually doesn't relate to anything to do with actual human well-being. It's simply a measure of the rate at which this Wendigo Inc. monster is monetizing the unmonetized resources of the living earth, and monetizing human activities. And so sort of turning our very human hormones and desires for a happy life into eyeballs for the smartphone to sell advertising dollars to gain more profits or whatever it might be. So once we begin to recognize that this Wendigo Inc. is this essentially this psychopathic type of entity that is devouring our world. And then we see that if you look at the 100 largest economies in the world today, 69 of those 100 are not countries, but transnational for-profit corporations. It gets to be quite terrifying. And this is not pointing the finger at one or two people and saying they're the bad people, but we are living within a system that is designed not to enhance well-being, not to enhance life on Earth, but literally to destroy it as fast as possible in order to increase this self-reinforcing profits.
GDP is a very suspect metric. Not only does it not quantify the right things for well-being, but it's almost always presented as GDP per capita, right? And that averaging makes it look like there's progress, even if only a few people got all the money and everyone else went backwards. So there's a lot of weirdnesses in our calculations that would have to be corrected in order to move in a more benevolent trajectory. And that leads me to, like, what are the general contours of the kinds of political and legal changes you think are necessary, right? Should we be looking at simple and holacracy or democratic socialism, or what's the sort of general political change that would have to happen and fairly quickly to help us move in the right direction?
Well, both simple and holacracy are two ways of rethinking ways of organizing that I think are very valuable. But I think what is most important to recognize is that what we need when we're looking at our underlying system is not just incremental changes. And there's not one or two fixes that are going to do what needs. Even when we're looking at climate breakdown, investing in renewables is a wonderful thing. We need to do more of it, but that's not enough. And it never will be, because as long as we have this growth-based system, this civilization is basically based on extraction, resource exploitation, and wealth accumulation as its fundamental value, nothing we do is going to actually redirect us in the way that we need. So what I'm calling for is actually a re-envisioning of our civilization itself, what some people call an ecological civilization. It's as though we're looking at changing the operating system itself of the civilization rather than just trying to do bug fixes at the more superficial layer. And if we looked at that different kind of operating system, an ecological civilization would be basically a civilization that is based first on the principles of life, the principles that have allowed ecosystems to flourish over millions and millions of years resiliently, with abundance, and not destroy themselves. And it would have as its foundational value the long-term well-being and flourishing, of setting the conditions for that flourishing for every human being on Earth in a regenerated and healthy living Earth, recognizing that it's not humans basically trying to exploit the rest of Earth, but developing a place of symbiotic living where what is good for us as humans is actually good for the Earth itself. And what I explore in the last chapter of the book, that this is not just some pie in the sky vision. These are actually ideas that are being implemented, being lived in different groups and different ways of thinking and different self-organized companies and different approaches around the world. And once we begin to realize what's actually possible, I believe we've got some possibility of making this transformation happen in the time frame that's needed, which is a lot shorter than I wish it were.
Mentally, emotionally, I'm morally convinced of the need for an ecological civilization. And a lot of the people I talk to feel the same way. And yet I read all this week that the Amazon rainforest is now producing more carbon than it's absorbing as of this week. So what are the ways in which you're optimistic, and what are the ways in which you're pessimistic, at least in the short to midterm?
I personally have essentially jettisoned those whole sort of words around optimism and pessimism, because it was Rebecca Solnit who pointed out in an excellent book called Hope in the Dark, that either of those places to be is really a cop-out. Because if you're an optimist, you're going to say, well, things are going to end up okay, so I don't have to get involved. And if you're a pessimist, the opposite. You'll say, we're headed for destruction, for doom, so nothing I can do is going to make a difference. So let me just look after myself anyway. But what I'm more interested in is a sense of how we can actually look at the destruction that's taking place, how we can really look with our eyes open clearly, not try to hide the devastation that is happening right now, the realization that our whole global economy is expected to triple by 2060, and that devastation will only keep growing at a faster and faster pace. How can we disregard these, what I see as these really dangerous myths of things like green growth. It says, oh, through the use of technology, we can make it all work out. So this is reason for optimism or whatever. So looking really clearly at how bad things actually are, they're getting worse, and we're headed at an accelerating path to quite potentially collapse of this civilization within this century. And at the same time, recognize that there's not an inevitability, because everything in this whole human system and the human system within the living earth is a mass layers of complex systems, these with its complex feedback loops interconnected with other things. We were talking before about the difference between a mechanistic complicated machine and a complex system. Well, as we look at the future, there's no doubt about it, it's probably the most complex system that anybody could ever conceive of. What that means is, by definition, we can't predict. We can look at all kinds of graphs and add the lines up and say we're headed for destruction. But what we also know is that each of us are actually part of that co-created system. Each of us together co-creates the future. And once we see that, we realize that it's not a spectator sport. It's not something that's happening out there. The very way in which each of us engages and the way we live our lives, the very statements we make, the actions we take, are all part of what will actually happen in that future. So a lot of it ends up just kind of accepting the mystery that none of us knows, and accepting that it's only by really looking with open eyes at the destruction that's taking place, recognizing that each of us are living entities with agency that can actually make a difference, that we just have no choice in my mind but to engage fully and do what we can with others through this interconnected complex system to try to transform the direction we're taking.
You're a guy who's obviously put a lot of effort into trying to get a really big, really rich map of reality, right? And so that makes complete sense in terms of, well, we need a really good model to help us more benevolently move forward or more gracefully transition through apocalypse or whatever it is that's coming. But in addition to that, do you personally feel like there's a moral obligation to try to ever better understand the dynamics of psyche and world and cosmos? Is that, you know, how existential is that for you?
That's like, and I was at Aristotle, who basically says that's our sort of our purpose, and like the an unexamined life is not a life that's worth living, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I feel that it's not so much about a moral obligation, because oftentimes whenever I sort of think of moral obligations, I go back to that sort of split way of thinking that we've been exploring in this conversation a lot, as if like I am then telling myself, oh, I should be doing this, and if I'm not, there's something wrong with me, and then I get caught right back in that dichotomy again. So I think of it more as another Aristotelian term that I think is so valuable, is he came up with this concept of eudaimonia. And he contrasted eudaimonia with hedonia. And if hedonia was this way of living where we just try to do whatever feels better from one moment to the next, eudaimonia, he defined as really an organism pursuing its fullest purpose in life, really getting driven by absolutely finding its fullest fruition. And eudaimonia really relates a lot to what we described earlier as that self-organized purpose of life to regenerate itself that it's been doing against entropy for billions of years. And if we think of ourselves from the point of view of eudaimonia, that actually fits with this notion of an integrated consciousness. What we really want to do as human beings is truly fulfill our well-being, which again is not like this, oh, I'm going to look out for number one and screw the right. To actually really fulfill our well-being is to recognize we're part of a fractal holarchy of greater and greater layers of well-being all the way to Gaia, to the whole living earth. But once, if we're doing that, that feels to me like the true fullness of life. And some people might have an overactive conceptual consciousness, which is kind of probably true in my mind. And part of that well-being might be to really try to understand and make sense and put these things together. But that doesn't have to be the way each of us pursues our well-being. So somebody else, it could be just being in nature, or having a deep connection with one animal, or with a garden, or but always recognizing ourselves as part of something embedded in something larger, and just offering kindness and compassion to those around us. Everyone's got their own path to truly pursue their well-being, but that's what I say is the imperative. And it's not the imperative of the I telling the self you should do that, but the imperative coming from every one of the cells, those 40 trillion cells that each of us have in our interconnected coherent bodies, to say, I want to be part of a fully fulfilled integrated organism.
Fabulous. You know, I think the book and also all the answers you've given here today are very, very big, very cogent, very principled, very coherent, very self-consistent. And so I absolutely appreciate the work you've been doing. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Yeah, well, thank you, Layman. Thanks for just asking great, deep, profound questions in themselves. I think it's been a wonderful conversation. Really appreciated it.